Hello and welcome to episode 50 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. We have a very special episode today. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grunislav, depending on who you ask, and with me as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chandler, and with us for the very first time, we would like to welcome our special guest. Hello, Richard Cobbett.
Hi there.
Hello, Richard Cobbett. Thank you for being on our podcast.
Yes,
you are quite welcome. And I should point out, I have an Oculus Rift sitting less than a foot away from me, still in its box, so...
Yay. Wow, priorities.
Yeah.
Well, you can't play adventures on it yet, so, you know, whatever.
Oh, well.
Take that, Facebook.
Yeah.
Group one. So, for those of you who don't know Richard, he has written for a lot of magazines and a lot of websites like PC Gamer, Rock Paper Shotgun, and he is now... You're freelancing now, Richard? You've been doing it for a while?
I've been freelancing for a few years, yeah, but still basically writing to the same people.
Cool. So, yeah, and you have, from our discussions, we've noticed you have a lot of knowledge about adventure games specifically.
And I'm very good at bluffing. I don't know if that counts.
Well, Richard also does a fantastic piece, is it every Saturday?
It's every Saturday.
Yes,
Saturday Crapshoot.
Called Crapshoot, where you feature several adventure games and you point out some very interesting insights and kind of tear down the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia and make us realize that maybe these things weren't so great after all, which I really appreciate.
Sometimes. I mean, Crapshoot, I should put out, is more intended as like a celebration of sort of the weird and odd. I mean, it's, when we first came up with the idea, it was going to be like, let's do the worst games of all time, but that sort of seemed a bit depressing and boring. So instead, we kind of moved to kind of sort of stuff which you've probably not heard of, you've probably not kind of played through, and kind of writing sort of far too many sort of snarky words about them. So some good, some bad, but all kind of, you know, interesting and fun.
Good.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, a lot of people hear Crapshoot and think crap as in crap as opposed to the craps game.
Yeah.
Where you get like this roll the dice and see what happens kind of thing. So.
It's a name that we should have changed years ago, but we're now stuck with. So it was basically either that or something like archive diving, and kind of Crapshoot just sort of had more zing to it. So.
It's okay. Yeah, it's good. I made a game called Backdoor Man, and I still haven't heard the end of that one, so I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, yes. So
let's talk about games. We should go over what we've been playing recently. Richard, have you been playing anything you can talk about that's of note recently, other than reading some terrible books?
I played this really awful game called A Golden Wake. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Oh, God!
It's like a sequel to Laura Bow.
Oh! Oh,
my
God. I like this guy already.
Sorry.
I played that. I had the misfortune of playing that one, too.
My big one of late has been 80 Days, probably on iPad. Inkle Studios, really, really fun sort of steampunk take on Around the World in 80 Days. It's kind of obviously based on the book, but, you know, apart from the premise, it has nothing to do with it. It's sort of its own universe, its own style, and it's really, really cool.
Good. I've been lamenting the lack of good steampunk games playing Arcanum recently. I'm like, this could have been done a lot more than it has. So that's good. I should hopefully it comes out on some platform that I actually have and then can try. Hopefully they do it for Android.
Well, Sorcery is, so hopefully at some point. It's the same engine.
Good. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talking about it, but haven't actually really looked at it yet. So, yeah, I love steampunk, so I have to look at that. That's good.
Well, this one you like, basically, so you leave London to go to Paris just on a train, and then you approach the ocean. It's called the Amphitrite Express, Amphitrite being the wife of Poseidon, I believe. And you're just sort of on this train, you're kind of getting closer and closer and closer, and then suddenly the guard just sort of walks, just sort of casually, right, we're going underwater now. And then it just turns into the Amphitrite Underwater Express, and then a couple of minutes later you're in Paris. Sorry for me to jump in.
If only the actual, like, Eurostar was that effective and efficient.
Well, give it time.
Yeah, give it enough.
Francisco, you've recently completed Grand Theft Auto V. Lucky you.
Yeah, lucky me. I took the day off yesterday. I took my first day off in I don't know how long specifically to play games, and I figured I might as well finish GTA V, and I did, and that was a
pull
thing.
Back too.
Yeah, exactly. That was a few hours of my life that I'll never get back.
You looking forward to the next Grand Theft Auto game now, having finally completed that?
Well, the next Grand Theft Auto game, I'll need to get a next-gen console, which I'm not prepared to do yet. And the only way I'll look forward to it is if it's set in Vice City and it's not a standard white male protagonists, etc. But that's a whole.
You're starting to sound like me. This is a worry.
Well, you know, it was bound to happen eventually. But in positive news, I've been playing Bioshock. Yeah. I've been playing Bioshock, and I finally have just started getting into it, and I'm really enjoying it. So I'll probably play more Bioshock this weekend.
Then take a break and play Bioshock 2. It's brilliant.
Okay.
First hour, shit. Then it's brilliant.
Well, I have such a backlog. I mean, I'm planning on playing The Last Express very soon as well as...
That is a hell of a backlog.
Yeah, I know. And I... I've got The Last Express, I've got Normality, I've got Prisoner of Ice, I've got...
These are all 90s games.
I know! That's how long my backlog is.
Wow.
I still have to play The Last of Us. I have Planescape Torment to slog through at some point, so...
Slog through.
Well, it's going to take a while.
It will.
I'm fully prepared.
You do it right.
Yeah, and I will. I'm planning on reading every single line of text in that game. What do you mean? No,
you are not.
What?
You not? You won't read them all. There's too many.
Well,
you won't find them all.
Is that a challenge?
If you want to make it quicker, so there was an official Planescape Torment novelization, which is crap and not worth bothering with. But some fan basically ripped all the text out of the game and novelized that instead.
Oh.
And so there's this huge thing you kind of sort of download in principle and kind of online readable form, which is the actual dialogue and kind of, you know, the full story.
Without the crappy combat, sounds lovely.
Yeah. Oh, you can hit yourself in the face a few times if you want, but it's not... like the game, it's usually not mandatory.
No, you can... Has it still got the bit about the person paying you 1,000 gold to let them kill you or whatever it is? I forget.
That I don't remember.
Spoilers.
That was a good bit. What's that, sorry?
I said, don't know spoilers.
Oh, yeah. That's hardly a spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Yeah. Anything else you've been playing other than Bioshock?
I've been playing the role of... No, I don't know. I had a joke there, but my mind is too sleepy to come up with anything. No!
That was never going to make it to joke status.
Nope, it wasn't.
That was going to be disappointment from the start.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of disappointment from the start, let's talk about Sierra! I am the master of segues.
Okay.
So just this morning, apparently Sierra's coming back.
Yeah,
well, that topic covered. Let's move on.
That is a word I really liked 20 years ago. I can't wait to see that word again.
Yeah. Well, I have to be honest. I've now played through 2 Sierra games, so you know maybe this will make it more exciting for me to King's Quest. You know, hey, let's do it. Let's go there. Mm-hmm. I'm ready.
Well,
you've got the game sitting there.
You played King's Quest V, and you also played
Quest for Glory.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, Quest for Glory was great. That was actually really, really good. So,
yeah. Quest for Glory 4 is one of my favorite adventures of all time.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Yeah,
I kind of never got exposed to big name games much as a kid because I was mostly playing shareware. You know, so I played mostly weird stuff, and the only experience I'd had before with Quest for Glory was Quest for Glory 5 demo, which I loved, but I had no idea who the company was or what this game... I had no idea that it was totally different from the earlier games or anything like that. So playing Quest for Glory 1 was fantastic for me.
And also, as I've told you several times, the demo of Quest for Glory 5 was in no way representative of the final product, which made it even more exciting because of the fact that you could run around and pick up stuff like lying on the ground and just not do anything. And it was kind of them saying, hey, look, it's 3D. We're going to have multiplayer, which they never did.
Ooh. Yeah. I remember Escape from Monkey Island had the multiplayer option, too, in the actual final game.
Sorry, what? Yeah. Escape from Monkey Island?
Yeah. It was a joke. Right, of course. Yeah, sorry.
I always thought they should have made a fourth one, but... Maybe the guys who did Sam and Max could have done it, because they still seem to really know what was going on.
Well, we never know what could happen in an alternate history.
That's absolutely right. So, speaking of history, we should get on to our topic. What's our topic for this week, Ben Chandler?
We are going to talk about, well, we're going to ramble on the subject of adventure games in the past, the evolution of the genre and different forms of the genre, because it is a fairly multifaceted genre. Nowadays we think of adventure games and you think point and click adventure, you know, but there's been a lot of different forms, you know, and I thought it would be fun to have a look at them and see some of the things that we've lost, some of the places that we've gone now, like what I call the post-adventure games, like, you know, what Quantic Dream do and Dreamfall and stuff like that. And, yeah, and just have a look at it and see what the genre has done and the various strengths. And I didn't mean to sum up the whole topic that quickly, but anyway, that's done.
Well, I'd like to throw in...
games are good.
Yes, I'd like to throw in my two cents of talking about, I think you mentioned two, tradition and versus innovation in, like, modern adventure games, and, like, how some developers, who we won't name right now, are sticking to old tropes and not moving on to things that could be done better. So
yeah, I think I was talking to someone the other day about the idea of the whole, you know, because you hear every 2 seconds, you know, the adventure game genre is dead or the adventure game genre reborn. When I think really, you know, the genre never died, just our tolerance for it died for a few years when we were subjected to countless Towers of Hanoi puzzles and
we sent into exile in Germany and it seemed to work out quite well.
Really, actually, that's really what happened.
Well, I mean, when you've got the Germans making their own Simon the Sorcerer games of all bloody things, then yeah.
What, have you played those, Richard? Because I have.
I have. They're kind of odd for that sort of sense of, am I actually playing this? It's like, what? But they're not really worth sort of tracking down on their own merits.
Oh man, Richard, did you play, that same company did a game called Everlight of Magic and Power or something like that? Did you play that one?
Everlight.
I think it was called Everlight. It was basically like Harry Potter, but the kid like goes to this alternate magic world, and like you can switch between day and night because the town has a curse on it where like the inhabitants go crazy or something at night, and I don't know.
It's all like Simon's Quest with a cursor. No, I don't know that one. I shall check it out.
Oh, well, yeah, it's terrible, but it's by the same company, but the one thing that stands out to me in that game is just, like, you know, you often get people criticizing how games can suffer because of poor translation. There is actually a line where, like, a female character is reading something, and they didn't edit out the bit where she's like, yes, blah, 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 am I pronouncing that correctly?
One of my favorite ones like that is the cough erotica game Lula 3D, there's a point where you're basically sort of sneaking through a sex club somewhere in San Francisco, and you're sort of listening in on this guy having a conversation, and he's just basically, hello, what, I don't know, just in German, just like one line, and then he sort of stops and like, avocados? I've completely lost track of what this plot is, and then you get to the end of the game and there's a shootout and all of the barks are in German. Oh. And it's like, kind of clearly nobody who was working on this game could be bothered to finish it even once.
Just to check. Dear. I have to ask, was that conversation the best part of that game?
Oh, there are so many great moments in that game. It's sort of like Sam and Max. Only sort of Sam and Max hit the skids. It's basically a porn star kind of going on much the same kind of sort of journey throughout America, except this time when she gets to sort of Mount Rushmore, there are people just sort of randomly having sex around us. I said, if you walk up to you, it's throughout the entire game, you've got these people just sort of sitting around and rutting. And if you move the cursor, you actually get your effing couples. I'm not sure what your tolerance of swearing is, but they don't do anything. You can't talk to them. You get some sort of line about kind of, I'd better not disturb them. But but also you sort of get to like the third part of the game. It's like, oh my god, this game thinks it has a plot. That's adorable. And so you end up on this sort of Trans-America quest to rescue three triplets. And if I remember correctly, you only ever actually find two of them, but the game just sort of ends. What just happened?
Maybe the third one was reserved for DLC, which never actually got made. Who knows?
It's an amazing game. I think the highlight has to be there's a point where you're at a truck stop, and this woman's basically just robbed the diner, and more or less she sort of runs out and sort of bumps into your character Lula, and it's just like, what are you doing? He said, I've got to go quickly. And then suddenly you're having a shootout with cops. And it's all like Thelma and Louise is like, yes, I will murder policemen. Let's have sex. It's just, it's amazing, but in all the wrong ways.
Wow.
You're not making it sound very erotic. You're not making it sound very sort of appealing in that sort of sense. More in a sort of parody of itself.
Oh, it's not. It's not. It's the least sexy game you can imagine. but like a lot of kind of games that are sort of trying to sort of be sexy, it's hilarious. Yeah. I said with Crapshoot, I kind of got a sort of certain level which they have to be. So like, there's nothing rapey, there's sort of nothing hardcore and, and lots of things. But I've got a lot of mileage out of supposedly erotic games which are just so funny. Yeah. Look up Venus Hostage. That's probably quite a good one to jump into.
Okay,
but anyway, I digress, please.
My Google search history can handle it. Yeah, okay, so... we didn't even get started on the topic, but that's fine.
That's fine.
That's good. I'm glad we got to talk about the 3D, because I don't think I'm ever going to play it.
What are you talking about? You play all the games. You're like,
You are
totally... You can't deny the fact that you're probably on eBay right now looking for a big box copy of Lula 3D.
Oh, man, I just...
Well, to try and sort of segue it back on, you sort of talk about progressiveness in gaming. And obviously throughout history, kind of many games have sort of had different big selling points, like kind of The Last Express and Border Zone had the real-time thing. You had Grim Fandango with its 3D. And Lula 3D is practically the same thing, in the form of a big sticker on the front of the box announcing it has bouncing boobs technology.
Ah, yeah. I've heard about that, yeah. And does it live up to the hype?
It does not.
Oh, what a... That's terrible.
That's
I always hate it when innovation fails.
Where was the physics engine when you needed it?
Yeah. It was kind of like Blade Runner with its voxels and its advertising, its amazing voxels and real-time also, which kind of just amounted to, hey, look, this character's not in the same place as they were before. Big deal.
And sometimes that was the chair full of scorpions.
Yeah. I forgot about the chair full of scorpions. Clearly, I haven't played the game in a long time, but yeah, it all came rushing back to me.
It's one of the many random things. Basically, like a lot of Blade Runner, they make the mistake of assuming that the absence of a clue counts as a clue, even though the only way you're going to know if you're the designer. And so, there's a point where you go into this club to sort of interrogate the owner, and randomly, his chair will be full of scorpions.
Why not?
I don't get, like. I haven't played The Last Express. That's on my backlog as well. But I haven't yet seen like the idea of real-time adventure not be somewhat annoying. Like since Lure of the Temptress, it's always been like, oh, I have to go and find this person. You know,
I would say that The Last Express does it the best that I've ever seen it. Okay. So I mean, the traditional problem whenever people do real-time stuff is that you generally have to know exactly what you're doing, otherwise you run out of time and you fail.
Yeah.
So the Last Express, immediately you can rewind time whenever you want, so you know you can't really screw up. It'll only sort of set you back a few minutes, usually. Okay. The other thing is that there's not that much happening on the train at any one time, so if you just kind of move up and down, it's not like you're really missing anything by watching a thing. I mean, arguably not enough happens on the train, but you know, you're generally okay. But also they use it for puzzles. And there's one puzzle in particular which I absolutely love. Minor spoiler, so I'll try and keep the plot element out of it. But there's a MacGuffin on board the train called the Firebird. It's basically this sort of jeweled egg that a couple of the characters are after. And there's basically a point where you steal it, and then one of the baddies wants to get it back. And so what you're meant to do is to take it through the train and kind of hide it where a wolf has been put into the kennels at the back. It's a tame pet wolf, it's fine. So you sort of put the egg back there in the kennels. And then basically when they kind of come up and sort of say, right, give us the Firebird, you can kind of sort of hold your hands up and kind of go, what? I haven't got the Firebird. But what you could also do is take the Firebird, go into your room, lock the door, and just sit there until the baddies have to get off the train.
Oh, nice.
And that works. It's enough of a simulation that sort of thing will actually...
Yeah, that's clever. I like that.
It's sort of like a solution that has emerged through the systems of gameplay rather than a puzzle design.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's scripted, but it feels like you're... you're beating the game by using its own rules, and I always love that.
Something
should work, and even though it's not the ideal thing, the designers are kind of sort of just bent things enough and kind of said, look, we're going to give you that one because that actually makes total sense.
Good. Yeah, that's a good idea. I like that.
Yeah, I like the idea of just a mechanic like that. Like, to take it out of the adventure genre, like Hitman, especially like the second one and the fourth one, I just always enjoyed the idea of just, you know, being able to play out the missions in different ways, and if adventure games could do that more, that would be...
I genuinely consider Blood Money to be an adventure game.
Yeah, it pretty much is.
I know that you've got the gun, but I mean, if you actually sort of look at what you're doing, you've got these real-time vignettes which kind of play out. You've got the plot elements that sort of take place depending on where you're going. You've got kind of characters who do stuff. You've got this entire thing, and basically your job isn't to kind of go in there and shoot everyone. It's to basically be the monkey wrench in the works.
Yeah.
You know, to find the point at which you can kind of use the environment, what you know about the character, to your advantage. And to me, that's adventure game.
Yeah. There's certain missions in that game where, not to spoil it because I've been nagging Ben to play it for ages, but there's two missions in particular that I can think of where, like, the solutions, one of the particular solutions in each mission is just, it's amazing, and I'm referring to the opera one and the guy who's in witness protection, and you have to, yeah. And yeah, the two solutions in those bits, in those scenarios, are pretty great.
I think that's like when you talk about adventure games, that's the sort of stuff like problem solving like that is why we get drawn to the genre originally. Like, instead of running around and shooting faster than everyone else and running faster than everyone else, you're being creative and actually coming up with solutions. And a lot of the things that people put in adventure games as puzzles, like the sliding tiles and stuff like that, that's not really why we play the genre. That's not, you know, creative and exploring. That's just, you're not allowed to go any further until you do this annoying bit.
Well, yeah, I've always held that adventure games have sort of two fundamental problems, kind of mostly sort of tied to sort of nostalgia and memory. That when you go back to the original games, puzzles were basically all they could do, so that's what they did. But it got locked down into that, therefore, adventure games were about puzzles. And like, I mean, some adventure games are. I mean, something like Myst is definitely about puzzles. But for the most part, the puzzles are extrapolations of the fact that they couldn't do anything more complicated with those worlds. So if you go back to like Maniac Mansion, obviously that's way more open than most later games. But I don't think anybody would say that it's not an adventure. And I think the other thing, which is always a mistake, is that people look back and they forget how advanced adventures were in every single way. They forget that when you go back to sort of the 80s and 90s, adventures were the genre that showed off new graphics technology. They were the ones that sold CD drives. They were the ones that sold sound blasters. They were the ones that basically experimented with all the clever ideas. And where you went to see game design and kind of computer gaming in general at the absolute cutting edge. And it's only really with, post-Doom that they kind of sort of curled back up into a ball and were kind of like, well, we'll remind you a bit of Monkey Island and that'll be enough. And it's like all of the classics did something which to many kind of fans would break the rules, you know, whether it's Quest for Glory's combat or the real-time stuff or kind of look at Full Throttle. Everyone hated that at the time because it was too easy. Whereas you play it now and it's actually this really tight piece of design with that focus on physical puzzles. Tim Schafer's infamous story about the sandwich and the door. You know that one?
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I'm sure everyone listening knows that one. But it was just when you actually play the game, it's the physicality of the puzzles. Like when you've got to go and steal petrol from somewhere, and then it turns out that you don't do it by kind of coming up with some convoluted way of getting into the building and sort of defeating the security. You set the alarm off and you siphon it out of the cop car that comes to arrest you.
And
it's just this is the kind of thinking which personified all of these games, and then somehow it sort of turned into being, well, if we give you a mouse pointer and maybe if we have some puzzles, and then a dialogue tree that will take you 10 freaking hours every single time, then we'll be like Monkey Island. And it's like, no, yeah, you won't. If you invent something like the three trials, if you have the real-time element of the shopkeeper going into the woods, if you come up with like a new setting, if you find a way of telling jokes in a different way, if you have the split of, you know, the adventure and the RPG element later on, then you can be Monkey Island. Otherwise, you're probably just being a bit boring.
I think also, like, the puzzles in the original Monkey Island were really, really diverse and creative within the limitations, you know? Like, you had the insult sword fighting, you had switching the grog from mug to mug, you had the dance steps that you had to follow, watching the shopkeeper open his safe. There was a lot of different stuff, even just walking over a plank multiple times, this real physical idea of, you know, exploring and finding out how this interface works.
And of course, it being brave enough to subvert that with the idle puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of my favorite puzzles of all time, just because of how it's a parody of itself, you know, and it really works well, you know. It works within the logic of the world. And, I think people forget how creative Monkey Island really was within its set of limitations.
I think there's a great joke that, unfortunately, people who played, I guess, maybe for the first time. I actually didn't discover the joke until a subsequent playthrough of Monkey Island. But there's a great bit if you wait long enough. I mean, obviously there's people if you wait long enough and Guybrush dies if you actually wait the 10 minutes. But if you sit there and, like, after about 2 minutes, these two legs come up on the dock and they're like, "Hey, I just robbed somebody. I've got this sword. Quick." Or like, "I have this sharp object. Quick, toss it in the water." And then there's a pause and it's like, "Nah, I think I'll keep it," and then they walk away. That's brilliant. That's comedy gold right there.
Well, I think the Monkey Island's problem, I think, going back, is that a lot of the I think a lot of the jokes which people sort of focus on aren't really that funny in terms of kind of the world interaction and so on. It's kind of more kind of a cute likability, you know, because the dialogue's not, for the most part, that kind of sort of gut bursting. Kind of the descriptions sort of tend to be a bit on the plain side, but then you need that kind of level so that stuff like that can be funnier than it would be if everything was sort of trying to have to make you laugh hysterically. Yeah. My favorite individual joke in Monkey Island 2, and it's really, really minor, is when Guybrush is diving for the ship to go and get the monkey thing. And when he sort of leaps back, he leaps out of the water backwards. Just turns to the screen, just shoots a grid, and just gets back onward.
It really got away with being very self-aware, like with Herman Toothrot, like grinning at the camera and that sort of thing, you know. They really got away with a lot of that.
Well, I think it had the advantage that it was the right kind of self-aware humor that it never does what I absolutely despise, and let this be known that I consider this to be an absolute crime, of doing something shit but joking about how it's doing something shit.
and it's like, I hate
that. I hate that so much. It's like kind of, hey, this is a bit of a cliched story, isn't it? Yes, and it still is. Write a better one.
So you knew you were doing wrong and you still did it anyway? Yeah. It's like even worse.
A Towers of Hanoi puzzle. Isn't that a real dumb, time-wasting thing? Mm-hmm. Versus, say, BioWare in Citadel, the last expansion for Mass Effect 3, which is amazing. There's actually a Towers of Hanoi arcade game that you walk past at one point. It was like, obviously, a riff to the fact they've done that bloody puzzle like 5 times, and you sort of try to use it, and Shepard just has some sort of response like, kind of, no.
Yeah. I think I talked about this, I think, last episode with Francisco. There's the start of Far Cry Blood Dragon. They shut all of your controls down and make you go through how to play the game guide, and the character's moaning about it the whole time as if it's some clever thing, and I'm screaming about it going, "Just let me play, he's right," you know, just because he's complaining about it. That doesn't make it funny or right that you've done this. We've been playing first-person shooters forever, let us go, you know? Mm. Just because you're self-aware of your mistakes doesn't make them any less of a sin. But,
yeah, versus, like, Portal, where you have the button when Wheatley sort of asks you to say something, and you press it, you just jump, and it's like, that's funny. That's a funny interface joke.
Yeah. Ben has not played Portal 2, another game I have nagged him incessantly.
You're making it sound like I haven't played anything.
You haven't played anything.
I am starting to wonder.
And you should be punished.
I'm busy playing all the games no one else has played. My to playlist looks like a crapshoot roundup, basically. I'm a masochist.
Yeah, well, hey.
I have a question for you, Richard. Do you like text passes? Do you think any game ever succeeded? Like, because I love the idea of a passer. I love, like, I don't know if either of you guys have played Beyond the Titanic, but there's this great puzzle where you can't fit through this crack in the wall with the lantern in your pocket, but you need the lantern to see. So you have to drop the lantern on the ground, tie the rope around it, and then tie the rope around your leg, and then crawl through the thing with the lantern trailing behind you. And I really love the idea of this really physical way of interacting, but the act of using a parser is so, like, often confounding and frustrating.
My thing with parsers is I think that they are fantastic when you type in a clever thing and the game does it. But what you actually end up doing is spending half an hour trying to persuade it what you want to do. And I always have this thing that if you've got a game which is actually, you know, open enough, is flexible enough to let me play with it to that extent, then have a parser. But if what you actually want me to do is pick up the thing and use the thing on the thing and talk to the guy, just give me the option. It's like I don't feel any more kind of connected by sort of typing, you know, ask man about Babelfish or kind of whatever. And especially when you sort of start getting into problems like international spellings and kind of grammar rules. A lot of the time when I mean, I've certainly played quite a few adventure games where I haven't actually known the terms, because obviously I'm English. I don't know kind of a lot of, you know, random American slang in particular. And when I played Legend of Lara, I got no idea what a lubber was. I was like, Christ, I don't know. I've got to say that while I'm aware of the meaning of the name, I just want to play a game where I have an inventory where I can invent things.
It's a racist joke, is what it is. But yeah. Actually, I was just having a discussion about this the other day. Like, parsers, I don't mind parsers, but the thing with parsers is that, in a way, they kind of expand how you can interact with the game world, but they also limit it because, you know, you have to be... No one can read minds. You can't possibly account for every single possible thing a player is going to type in. So, I mean, but having said that, if you're going to make a parser, at least... when you have puzzle solutions, you know, just kind of take into account the different ways that you can phrase things. And I cited as an example, and I know you did this one in a crapshoot, Hugo 2, Whodunit. As you may recall, as many flaws as that game has, there's a bit towards the end.
It's not really a game with flaws. It's more of a big hole, and then the fucking bits of a game on the edge.
So. Yeah. Well, I played that game as a kid, and I mean, I have to give credit to the first Hugo for teaching me how to type very fast, because having to type exactly, and I'll give money to, or take gold from mummy or whatever. But anyway, at the end of Hugo 2, towards the end of Hugo 2, there's that safe, and you don't have to open the safe to finish the game, but if you don't, I don't think you get the optimal ending or something. And the way to open the safe is you get that sonic screwdriver from Doctor Who in that delightfully...
From the Doctor.
Subtle... Please. Oh, excuse me.
you sicken me.
I'm not a Whovian, I'm sorry. So I remember struggling with how to open the safe for years. Because, I mean, I remember I typed open safe with screwdriver and it wouldn't let me. And I tried every single variant of that. I mean, I even remember, like, typing, like, tap hinges with screwdriver, and the game thought I was, the HI in hinges was me saying hello. So I was like, tap hinges on save, and the response was, hello! And I was like, what? And years later, I finally one day decided, use screwdriver on save, and lo and behold, that's what the solution was.
Melt wizard. One of which I was quite liked was Leisure Suit Larry Love for Sale, which had this kind of interesting sort of mix.
So
whenever you clicked on something, you had like a selection of preset verbs, and they'd basically be all the ones you needed apart from the tutorial, and I think one other exception. But you could also type in your own verbs and kind of subjects of conversation. Sort of sometimes they'd have stuff, you know, just sort of tucked away hidden there. And it had this sort of nice extra feeling that I've discovered this joke, you know, I found this thing. And
Albion has something similar. Albion, you've got a whole list of topics you can choose from, but if there's a topic you want to ask them about that they don't know, that there's not in their list, you can just type it in and sometimes you'll get a response. That's nice.
That's one of the things. I mean, Ben, you always go on about exploration as gameplay, but I think
not
only just exploring the game world, but just exploring, like, just that. I mean, not just going around in a city, for example, and finding things, but just exploring what the game has. And what we were, I mean, to bring back Monkey Island, the first Monkey Island, I played it a bunch when I was younger, and I always felt like there was something new every time I played it. Because you had that richness of the different conversations you could go, even though it was essentially the same end result, you had different jokes that you could find, you had different things that you could, you know, just things waiting to be discovered, and that's something you don't really see too much anymore, which is a shame.
Agreed.
I wrote
for Rock Paper Shotgun a few years ago based on Larry Wan. There's kind of their regular column at the time called Gaming Made Me. And one thing I was sort of pointing out there was that a lot of the time with adventure games, it's not just... A big part of the appeal for me when I was suddenly growing up as a kid, before other genres even kind of close, was this feel of being in a place. And I think a core part of that was being able to poke and prod, you know, to get jokes, to read the signs, to feel... actually sort of part of that universe in a way that RPGs were sort of trying to do with sort of top-down views and basically nothing else was really trying to at all. And I love that kind of sense of a possibility space. I really want more games to kind of sort of to steal some ideas from some of the games which no one's ever heard of. Private Eye is a really cool example. I don't know if either of you have played that one.
No, I haven't played it.
It's basically based on the Chandler novel, The Little Sister. The game itself isn't fantastic, but it has one element that I think is absolutely brilliant, which is when you visit crime scenes, what items do you pick up? And the idea is that if you pick it up, then you have a clue. But on the other hand, if the police come to your office and they find you've got an entire cupboard full of the murder weapons... They're going to sort of lead to certain conclusions.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
I thought that was just kind of one of those sort of brilliant examples that I would love to see, you know, more of. Or an example I've used a few times is when you have to break into a building and you inevitably sort of try, with the exception, I should point out, of Blackwell Epiphany, which I was really pleased to see breaking this. there's a window. I have a brick. Use brick on window. And the response is always some sort of variant of, like, kind of, I can't do that, or you shouldn't do that, or kind of whatever. And obviously it would be much more fun if it did do that, but then obviously the alarms ring, and so you only have, like, maybe 3 minutes inside the building, whereas if you'd pick the lock on the door, you could have sort of taken your time. And so it kind of it affects the way that you approach the next part of the puzzle, you know, kind of how long you have to raid that room or kind of crack a safe, and just sort of how you don't have to kind of leave adventuring to have this much wider range of options rather than just puzzle.
Kind of like the Indiana Jones thing where you've got different paths you can choose, like the...
Yeah, but kind of with the idea of kind of you can do more stuff which is a bit freeform, like kind of a bit like RPGs will have kind of the different moral paths. I've always been surprised that adventures sort of don't have more... I mean, obviously, I know why. I mean, it greatly increases the amount of time they hit to make. But if RPGs and so on can do that anyway, and they have a way harder challenge than adventures do most of the time, with the exception maybe of being able to reuse some of the assets, it's always sort of seemed a shame that we haven't sort of seen more in the way of, there are three ways to do this, but what we want you to think about isn't how do you do this, but what are the implications of you doing it this way? And kind of, you know, there's never really been much in the way of, you know, befriending NPCs, you know, with a wider purpose. Just you talk to them and you empty their dialogue tree because they're there, then you get the clue to do the thing, or a trigger somewhere unlocks. And there's just sort of all this sort of still very, very untapped things that kind of individual games are sort of dipped into a little, but never really sort of jumped into both feet.
Yeah, I can think of, just offhand, one game that was really good about multiple solutions, although the way they handled it, it kind of just ended up becoming like a checklist thing, was Stacking. I really liked how how you could just, like, every single puzzle had like three or four different ways to solve it, but it just got to the point where it was just like, okay, well, the completionist in me wants to finish this, but it didn't really add much, you know?
Yeah. Well, Stacking had the problem that basically nothing required any actual effort at all, because there were many of them.
Yeah, that too.
anything that you did would solve the puzzle pretty much.
Yeah.
I was talking with you recently, Richard, about Conquest of the Longbow, which I think does something similar to that. It's a really cool idea where you can, like, you go through this world and, you know, do what you do to get through the game, but then at the end of the game you have to sort of answer for what you've done.
Yeah, if anyone hasn't played it, basically the gimmick is that you're playing Robin Hood. And a bit like kind of Chrono Trigger, which also has a really cool sort of trial sequence, it doesn't really hint that throughout the game that it's taking notes. It's just more or less, you know, if you want to sort of shoot this... Say, for example, a monk is coming down Watling Street, I think it is, and... There's a correct way of doing it where basically you sort of mug him gently, but you could also put an arrow through him and just sort of take his cloak or whatever else the case may be. And then basically the end of the game is that, like in most versions of the stories, King Richard comes back from the Crusades, and unlike reality, he's not a complete douche. Basically, by this point, Robin's already been captured, and so the sheriff sort of runs up. He says, "My lord, this is an outlaw. We are going to hang him, obviously." And basically, he does put you on trial on the grounds of, have you actually been the noble outlaw you claim to have been, or have you just been a thug?
That's really cool.
That was genius.
Yeah. I have to say...
Christy Marks, everyone.
Yeah, Conquest of the Longbow and Conquest of Camelot are easily the most underrated Sierra games, but they are probably the most fantastic of the Sierra games, to be honest.
I loved how kind of Conquest of Camelot has my favorite Sierra... One of my favorite Sierra deaths, where you start playing, and basically you head out on the quest. You've got to go and pray to these two shrines.
Yeah.
So like the shrine of I forget what they call it. Basically, it's sort of
I think it's the
Christian god of Mithras.
Yeah.
And basically, so let's say for example you pray to Mithras, but you don't pray to the Christian god. Then as you're walking out of the front gates, the portcullis just drops right onto your head.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, you didn't pray. Well. God has smote thee.
Yeah.
That's good, I like that.
Probably, yeah, the only time that a literal deus ex machina has killed you in Sierra game. I don't know if it's exactly a deus ex machina, but close enough. But yeah, Conquest of the Longbow. I guess Camelot still had a few sort of dead ends, and even though Conquest of Camelot, Conquest of the Longbow is pretty much copy protection the game, it's still...
I've called it that, definitely.
Yeah, it's still... I mean, it works within the context, I guess. But it's just... There's so many examples of it.
It was
but it's still a
kind.
Good game. Yeah.
Even by the time Conquest of the Longbow took the piss, it's like, kind of by the end, you're having to kind of sort of work out druid codes on your hand by referencing to specific trees.
Yeah.
After having picked out the correct shields and kind of... It's just...
And
I've bought the game, or more accurately, I've now downloaded it since it's been, you know, she made it 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Could we just go 1 minute without my having to tell somebody what a gemstone means or sort of something?
Yeah.
But it's still brilliant. It's still a fantastic game.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I do really like that idea of, like, of sort of consequence. Like, you see it in a lot of RPGs, like your Fallouts, your Arcanums, you know, and I guess I don't play a great deal of modern RPGs, but you get to the end of the game and they give you a kind of summary of, you know, this is what happened because of the result of your actions. And I think with adventure games, you know, a lot of the times you play these kind of, you steal a lot of stuff and you annoy a lot of people. And
you're basically a sociopath in like 90%
of
adventures.
You really are.
Yeah,
and it'd be great to see some of that, like, kind of come back at you and go, here you go. Actually, my friend Sebastian and I were once planning to make a game where you're this, like, old retired adventurer at the end of his days with an inventory full of stuff, and you have to go around giving it all back and apologize. We never ended up doing it, but yeah, that was...
I mean, Simon the Sorcerer 3D kind of plays with that a little. The basic idea is that you start playing, because sort of Simon by this point is an absolute prick. I quite like the first two Simon games. Simon 3D is just a mess. But one of the running themes for the first part is you keep on encountering people. Like, say, there's a guy at the bottom of a hole who is basically, "Oh, passing adventurer, please help me out of this hole." And normally you would, but in the case of Simon, it's just like, "I am going to make fun of you for being stuck in that hole." And so it's like you leave people. I think one person dies, and kind of all you're just kind of just sort of sauntering off, kind of, "I am Simon the Sorcerer. I'm a colossal tool." But then you kind of reach this sort of point about midway through where you have to kind of go and get the help of, like, the four legendary heroes or sort of some such stuff. And, of course, it's the four guys who you've completely screwed over. And just, like, kind of sort of sneaking back. It's like, kind of, right,
Tail between the legs.
I always thought... Really,
unfortunately, Simon's 3D was so bad, I don't think most people got to that point. So we're just like, I'm not playing as this guy. Uninstalls game, quits game, uses CD as frisbee. CD. Smashes pieces of CD. Scatters CD in garden. Sprinkles salt on it so that no game may ever grow again. Does not buy sequel. Sorry, I digress.
You obviously
tell us how you really feel.
Some memories. I have to be honest, I looked at the magazine advert for Simon the Sorcerer 3D and went, I'm never playing this game. I'm not touching this. Just from the advertisement, that was enough.
I never played Discworld Noir, but I always thought it would be fun, because especially in the first... I mean, I enjoyed the first... Well, I enjoyed two more than one, but I think that goes for everyone. But Discworld 2, I thought it was just amusing how Rincewind was just kind of constantly whining about how he was basically in an adventure game and like, oh, I guess I'm going to have to go on another pointless quest now and blah, blah, blah. And it was very fourth wall breaking, but I always thought it would be a fun sort of little gag if maybe in the future Discworld game you're playing as a different character and you run into Rincewind and he's like, aha, now it's my turn to send you on a pointless quest, and he like
I don't think it was Rincewind, but I'm almost sure that joke does exist in one of the Discworld games. There's sort of something like that.
I know in the second one, it's like there's like a troll or an ogre or something who has a toothache, and he's like, oh, I'll give it to you, I'll give you my item if you bring me like all these completely ridiculous things, and he sort of bypasses it. But I thought it would be funny to just like, you know, if Rincewind gives you the quest and then it's like some sort of really easy solution and you don't actually have to do it, and he's just like, well, that's not fair, or something along those lines.
Did you ever play The Color of Magic, Richard? On I think it was for ZX Spectrum.
The text adventure. Yeah.
The most we're going back to confusing passes. The most confusing thing about that is instead of north, east, south, west, they had the
Rimwoods and Hubwoods, isn't it?
And Turnwise and Widdershins. Oh man, that is so confusing to play. I get lost in that so easy. I just cannot play the game because of that.
Oh, well, if you think you're lost in that, you should try playing the Discworld Mud at some point. The map of Ankh-Morpork must have hundreds of rooms.
Well, it's a very rich world.
Oh, it's insane. I mean, they've built basically most of the disc, including vast amounts of it that haven't been in the books. But as I said, you only need to play the game. And if you do play the game, it's got some really clever stuff in it. But just look for the Discworld Mud map of Ankh-Morpork and prepare to sort of feel your eyes melting out of their sockets.
Okay. I'm a huge Discworld book fan, so yeah.
Oh, me too.
But yeah, I should nag Francisco to play Discworld Noir because it is pretty cool. There's not enough detective games, and since I've recently started watching films, I've only come to realize exactly how much it rips off Bogart films. Like a lot.
Well, in fairness, Discworld Noir is parodying them. I mean, it's
having watched a few Bogart films and going back to play it again, I went, I see everything here is a parody, every single bit of it, which is sort of a Discworld thing anyway. There's a lot of that going on in the book. So
I mean, I like Discworld because I think Discworld Noir, while obviously everything is a reference, I mean, there's a lot of Maltese Falcon stuff. It's the Sortie's Falchion or something. And then after a while, it sort of starts bringing in Lovecraft and so on into the mix just to kind of really mix things up. It's got the atmosphere that it needs. It feels right. It sort of feels like if the disc was going to do film noir, this is the film noir that it would do. Unlike, say, L.A. Noir, which is basically a guy sitting down to watch L.A. Confidential, missing the point, and then spending millions and millions and millions of dollars creating a game inferior noir to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And that is not intended as a slam on Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is actually really good noir. But genuinely, I mean, it's got the cartoons, but it has all of the right sort of sensibilities. Yeah. Even if I've never been able to work out where the saxophones came from, because they were never in the noir films, and so somehow they've become kind of part of the language along with the fedoras. And anywho, that's it.
I don't know. I liked L.A. Noir, but
You like anything that rocks up. No, that's
me. That's not true. That.
What did you dislike that they've made?
GTA 5? Well, I didn't dislike GTA 5. I just disliked the story of GTA 5. It didn't go anywhere. Just how it ended. It was very anticlimactic. But yes, well, now I'm digressing. Yeah, but at least the other ones, you know, they sort of have an arc, and there's all, you know,
GTA 4 didn't. You have the first island, and then basically nothing happens. You occasionally get a phone call from the villain, kind of going, "I'm still here," but otherwise it's sort of Nico kind of walking around with 30 grand in his pocket, kind of going, "Damn, I wish I didn't have to work for these people." It's like, you don't.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it, options.
It kind of had the whole thing of, like, you know, the guy from the old country that he had to settle his score with and whatever. But yeah. At least there was more intrigue than GTA 5, where it was just kind of like, wah, 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 we're old and has-beens, wah, wah, let's rob some banks, oh, now we're not, oh, family drama, oh, bicker, bicker, oh, I'm interesting.
Now Trevor says something funny.
Yeah, well, funny, in quotation marks. Anyway, yes.
GTA, fine adventure game.
Yeah.
Well, there's pointing and clicking if you play it on PC. There's that.
Yeah. So, Richard, you have made no mystery of the fact that you hate Towers of Hanoi puzzles and mazes and all those sorts of, and sliding block puzzles and all those sort of padding.
The elder puzzles, I always refer to them as.
Yeah. Why do you think? I mean, we've presented our theories, but why do you personally think that people are still relying on those old tropes to? When they make adventure games nowadays,
I think it's a mix of three things. The first of which is laziness. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but I very rarely use the L word. I'm well aware of, you know, how difficult it is to kind of make games, even something simple, even something bad. I really hate it when people, you know, say, "Oh, that game was lazy," because no, kind of a ton of work has gone into making anything, and I sort of don't want to, you know, roll that. But at the same time, kind of this is a sliding block puzzle or something. Is lazy. It is, we need a puzzle, can't be bothered to think of a puzzle, put a sliding block in there. Or it's, we need a puzzle, go and get some kiddie book of, you know, chess puzzles, and we'll put a chess puzzle in there. And it's like, if they were integrated into the world, I don't necessarily mind them. So, for example, if you have, say... I'm trying to give a good example. I mean, Towers of Hanoi, if you can well enough disguise it as being, you know, like, we're actually kind of sort of working on this machine, or kind of we're doing a thing, we're recharging droids or whatever, if it can be well enough disguised, I'm basically fine with it. What tends to really annoy me is when it's just sort of straight up, and now you have to solve a sliding block puzzle. Or you walk into a room, and it's, now we've got a chessboard here, and you've got to put the knights into the right positions. It's like, piss off, I've done this 1,000 times, and I never want to do it again. So I'm partly... there's that, you know, that people just sort of will descend into it because it's easy and slack. But I think there's also the fact that they're traditional, and I think a lot of adventure games in particular are kind of built with an idea towards what people are familiar with. The idea that sort of tradition is as a blanket that you can kind of wrap yourself around in. So it's like kind of we know our entire audience has played this, but that's okay because it's part of the games they love, therefore... they won't mind, or they'll like this, or we've got some clever subversion, which almost inevitably turns out to be the character kind of going, this is a bit stupid, which I think we've already covered. And then there was a third thing, but I'm kind of sort of blanking on it for the moment. But I think it's just that it's too easy to do, and everyone has done it. It's like the newspaper under the door with the pencil trick. It's like the first time you see that, that's clever, but the first time you see it, you're six. And it's like kind of sort of 20 years later, it's just an acknowledgement that we have no other ideas. We felt we had to put a puzzle here, and 9 out of 10 times, just having the door open would be fine.
Do you know the game where I first encountered that puzzle?
Oh, it could be anything. Broken Sword 3.
No, it was Hugo 2, actually.
Never mind, go ahead, Ben.
You go. I'm done. I was just going to postscript by saying that I know that in the crapshoot you screamed about that puzzle, because
I think to a large extent, it's to me that puzzle has... That puzzle in particular, there's a couple of other ones, but that one especially has this really arrogant subtext to it to me. It's like kind of, it's someone sitting there kind of going, yeah, sort of going, oh, I'm very clever and nobody will have known this. Like, everybody knows this. Your audience, it's a bit like when people would put copper protection onto adventure games, which always used to crack me up. It's like kind of, right, so you have now made playing your game a puzzle and you've put it in front of an audience of people who like to spend their spare time solving puzzles.
Yeah.
I don't reckon much to your chances. Also, photocopiers.
Yeah.
It's that sort of disconnect between, you know, sort of designer and audience. It really chafes because it's like, nobody can not know this puzzle anymore. I think if you're making a kid's game, if you're like making, I don't know, Putt-Putt Fights the Templars, then maybe, you know, I'll give you kind of a bit of leeway to kind of use that one then, because it will still probably be fresh. But it's like, if I'm kind of playing in a game intended for adults and you do that, then basically that is a confession that you have no ideas.
I want to see a gritty reboot of the Putt-Putt series that introduces elements of Carmageddon.
Putt-Putt Breaks Down.
Yeah.
I'd play that. I love Carmageddon and Putt-Putt's. Interesting, if simple. How do you feel about games that integrate the puzzles like Puzzle Agent and Professor Layton? They just go, look, we're a puzzle book.
Or the Seventh Guest.
With those ones, it doesn't bother me, because, again, that is the idea. But I do expect better puzzles. I don't think for it to its credit, I don't think Puzzle Agent really sort of did this that much, but I've played other games which sort of do, and I think to some extent it's fine when it kind of opens up and it's like kind of, oh, this puzzle. So say for example, the peg thing, you know, where you've got a triangular board and you've got to kind of jump over all of the pegs and whatever. If you frame that kind of correctly, then I think that sort of thing is fine for something like Puzzle Agent. If you've got that, a chessboard puzzle, but you've replaced the queens with sort of something, whatever, then, you know, fine. As long as your other puzzles get better than that, that doesn't bug me. It's really when they're kind of presented you out of context just to waste my time. Quest for Infamy did that. There's a point where you have to find this sort of seal, which has been hidden underground behind a door that you can only open if you have the correct sigil. But you open the sigil, and then that peg game is sitting there. And the only question is, why, on a narrative level, why is this here? It's like, nobody can access this unless they've got the thing which proves that they have the ability to be there. So why is it now only the smart person may pass this sort of like additional second test? It's like, if I see it and I can sort of have in my head that this is down there because it serves a purpose, it's probably fine. If it's the design is now pissing me about, then I get cross.
Yeah. I wish that in Quest for Infamy you could just come across a sliding tile puzzle, just smash the hell out of it and walk through.
That was genuinely what I was expecting. You got Sort Grand Inquisitor as a puzzle where you're playing as Brog or Brock or something like that, and you kind of walk across this mist sort of style chess puzzle, and you can kind of click on it, and kind of a couple of pieces will move around, and Brog just basically kind of goes, "I don't understand," but then you can. The solution is you pick up a rock and you smash the bloody thing and you take it out. Like, yeah, this puzzle Brock can do. And it's like, genius. It's like, man. Why isn't that how kind of Quest for Infamy sort of solves it? Like, just, you can solve the puzzle if you want, but otherwise, nah.
Zork Grand Inquisitor was such a great game. I've been meaning to replay it. That was such a fantastic game.
It's the only Myst-style game that I genuinely love.
Yeah, I think the problem with Myst-style games as well, like, I can handle Puzzle Agent and Professor Layton and all of that, but in a Myst-style game, you're wandering around this environment, and you've got 20 different puzzles you're trying to think about at once, and you're guessing a lot of the time, and you're never sure what's connected to what, whereas in a lot of the Puzzle Agent sort of ideas, everything's, like, self-contained, so you're not wandering cluelessly while also trying to solve puzzles.
I think a big problem I have with Myst, I mean, ignoring the obvious thing that it is the worst game ever made and a pox of its industry, the assassin of all that is good in existence and genuinely just toilet fodder.
Tell us how you really feel.
No arguments for me.
I'm not a fan. As I sort of said before, that given a choice between playing one or slitting my throat with one of the CDs, I would break one in half and start ripping, probably Riven. But anyway, I think what's always frustrating, though, kind of on a specific level, is I quite like the idea, a lot of the ideas that Myst has, in sort of terms like, we'll put you into this world and you'll learn the rules and you'll kind of sort of, you'll sort of, here's a machine and we're not going to tell you how to use the machine, but you've got to kind of experiment with it. And one of the fundamental problems I've always had with Myst, I think Riven actually did this less than most of the other ones, although it was way, way too hard for me. Sorry. But it never feels like I'm playing with a device. It never feels like this is a thing that could actually exist. This is a puzzle. And it's I don't want to feel like it's a puzzle. It's like kind of that give me a complicated system wherein I have to kind of move an armillary around to do a thing, to do a thing, to do a thing. I'm probably okay with that. Like the dig, I had no problem when it was doing that kind of puzzle. But we're now going to make it so obtuse with all of our unmarked buttons, and when you press the third button, this dial will sort of spin back, and it's like kind of no. If we're gonna do that, you've really got to kind of make it, you know, worth my time. And you know, for me, that kind of puzzle is just I'm facing a roadblock. I'm not facing an interesting thing to do. And it's like, if you want me to explore your world and feel past the world, get rid of the roadblocks and make the puzzle sort of feel naturally integrated. You're like a thing which I might actually need to play with. I mean, I'm trying to think of an example that sort of did it well, but you know, there aren't that many to sort of pick from. But something like, you know, even to some extent, something like Starship Titanic, which I didn't like very much, but it has that sort of sense of, yeah, nothing works for a good narrative reason. And you're sort of trying to work around where stuff which should work has broken. And kind of for me, it's kind of more plausible than at some point some idiot set up this ludicrous contraption and then forgot to leave a manual lying around.
Mm. And then the only thing it does is open up another thing which has another 10 buttons for you to press.
Right. It's like it's like a standard problem with any game which is sort of doing the archaeology thing. I had this with sort of Broken Sword 3 as well. I think not because it was an offender in the same way, but there's a point where you walk into a puzzle which has been set up to kind of keep a greedy king from the treasure. And it's like, kind of right, but the greedy king has dynamite.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Broken Sword 3 wasn't so much about sliding tower puzzles as it was about sliding crate puzzles, so there's that.
Don't remind me.
It is the most emotionally touching soccer band game ever.
That's a good way of putting it.
I have to say the whole wooden triangle peg jumping puzzle always makes me think of Cracker Barrel. And see, we have, there's these... having taken several road trips in Florida, one of the staples is Cracker Barrel, which is a nice roadside restaurant, which is basically, you know, sort of down-home, folksy, sort of southern food. But at all the tables, they have those little games with the little peg puzzle. And, you know, it's intended to help you pass the time, but imagine if, like, you went to Cracker Barrel and it was like, well, no one's going to come and serve you until you solve the peg jumping puzzle.
I'm actually going to give you an example where the peg thing has been done well. And it's not actually an adventure game, but there's a webcomic called Prequel. It's basically an Oblivion fan comic based about this sort of Kajita, like a cat person called Catcher Mannequin. And basically, it's so far been running for about 5 years, which has sort of covered like 2 days of absolute failure. Its subtitle is Making a Cat Cry, because basically it's sort of one of those things where the entire world just exists to make the main character miserable, but she's sort of slowly crawling her way out of that. And a recent plot thing is basically that she discovers that she can, and when I say recent, I mean like it's probably like 7 years ago at this point, but you know, recent in the time frame of this game. And one thing is that she learns that she can do magic, and she sort of gets this ghost of a dark elf, I think, to basically kind of give a basic training in telekinesis and like how to use it. And the way that he teaches her is by bringing out a table from a tavern which has that game in it. And so basically it's used as a confidence booster. So it's tied into the narrative because she's solving it with her telekinetic powers rather than her fingers. It's like, it's meant to be, we're not actually presenting this to be, and it's interactive. This is like a flash game. They made us sort of part of this. And so it's like, kind of the idea is that she's meant to be using her telekinetic powers to solve this rather than just sort of solving it for the sheer hell of it. It's wrapped into every failure she has. There's like extra dialogue about how she's sort of going, I can't do it. This makes no sense. It's like kind of, no, you're not thinking right. Think like this. And it actually sort of turns into this really uplifting thing. So obviously, if you've done the puzzle before, you know how to solve it, you can have done it in like one go. But if you keep failing it, then the idea is you kind of get slowly closer and closer to the solution as she gets kind of more and more comfortable with what she's doing. And then at the end, it's like you actually have this sort of huge moment of kind of her being so happy. It's just like, yes, I did it. Like, I solved this totally bullshit children's game, but I solved it with telekinesis. I accomplished something. And it's sort of genuinely, it ends on this high, and it's like kind of you have actually done the triangle peg puzzle well, and then you kind of go from that to Quest for Infamy to like bullshit puzzle.
Oh dear. So how should we for those aspiring game designers who would listen to our podcast, because I know everyone does, how do you move away from that? How do you say, you know, I mean, I've had instances where I've made games where, you know, there's a section where it might call for a maze, and I've put mazes in, but I haven't put in mazes where the goal is to just kind of get lost and figure out how to solve the maze. There's usually a trick to it, which I think is, you know, a nice compromise. If you're going to put in something like that, at least mix it up a little bit. But how do we move away from these just tropes, aside from just not putting them in?
Well, I think that's a fairly good starting point, to be honest. I think it's like a lot of things, in that with anything creative, there are no hard and fast rules. Everything will work in the right context, but you have to have a really, really good idea of what you're doing with that. And I think that something like a maze is very easy to talk yourself into thinking that you've got one, because the puzzle is really clever. When in fact, when you actually sort of lay it down, basically people are sort of still just doing the old Batman thing of kind of, I'm going to keep walking left. And I think kind of, unless you've got something which is really small, like say, I mean, I know that the game doesn't exist, but if it did, then Monkey Island 4's Mists of Time puzzle. It was a vaguely kind of fun, you know, sort of take on like a maze, you know, without you meeting yourself in a different time frame. And I think you can certainly have, you know, clever ways around it, but I think a lot of it just sort of is, do you have a burningly good idea for this, or are you putting the thing down there to fill time with the idea that you'll put a really good idea onto it later? And I sort of think that most adventures sort of tend to kind of sort of go with the second one. It's like, now I have a maze, I've got to think of a clever gimmick rather than, you know, it being a burningly good idea.
Right. Like, I even you do- in, yeah, in Tales of Monkey Island, they had a maze in the first episode with based on sound. So, yeah.
Yes, a special insult to death players. Huh?
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of the time when you play a game, especially adventure games, you really feel at times, there's no way that the beta testers didn't complain about this. You know, I feel that a lot. I'm like, if I was a tester, I'd be just going, how does this seem feasible? You know, why didn't anybody call out the QA? And I think a lot of the times you have to listen to feedback really closely. And if you've done something that needs to be fixed, and if you can fix it, don't be afraid of cutting a dumb puzzle just out completely. Because there's a lot of games where the experience would be improved by cutting out a puzzle completely and just letting you walk through that door.
Especially these days when people will tolerate a two-hour game if it's a good two-hour game, I mean, for the right price.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would way rather two really, really good hours than 12 hours of dull puzzles and, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Francisco recently told me that the special edition of Broken Sword has sliding tile puzzles on the sewer things, and I just... I don't remember what my reaction was, but it wasn't good. It wasn't healthy moment.
I mean, Broken's actually a great example of where more is less. Because not only the new puzzle's bullshit, it completely breaks the flow of the game.
Yeah.
Because you jump in, you've got this entire new story about Nico, which actually, to my mind, makes the story lesser. Because if I remember correctly, it's like her father is in some way kind of sort of tied to the conspiracy, which I don't like. I like the fact that you've got this sort of ancient conspiracy, these sort of two random people. You're kind of sort of fall into it and kind of make a mess of it. But it means you've got this whole narrative thing where she's sort of investigating that thing, and then suddenly you cut to George just sitting outside a cafe, and it's like, but this is your start.
Yeah.
Why?
They ruined the beautiful opening of the original Broken Sword.
I think,
you know, Harrison Fall, it makes me think of bullshit.
Yeah.
a big strength of Broken Sword was like how nice it was to explore the environment, but if you and like how nice it felt walking around the city, but if you're putting you know sliding tile puzzles on the sewers, that's never going to feel like a real city anymore. You know, well, you're taking that away.
Your reaction, and you brought up a very good point, was something along the lines of like, you know, oh, we're guarding our ancient secret in this sewer. Let's put a sliding block puzzle that any child coming by could just solve and fall into the sewers and be eaten by Charles Cecil the Crocodile Man.
I'd pay to see that.
Yeah, I actually live in the same town as him. I've been avoiding the middle of it ever since revealing Broken Sword.
Does he live in the sewers? Is he really a crocodile man as Ben has postulated?
Oddly, I've never been invited to his house, but a lot of the time you get the puzzle for the sake of having a puzzle. I can't think of a better example than Grey Matter. There's a puzzle where you've got to get basically you've got to steam a letter open. You know that's you know it that to me isn't an offensive puzzle. It's one which we all know, but it's the kind of thing which makes sense. It's like kind of the character would know that trick too. So it's like kind of okay. Well, that's a perfectly valid way of doing it. But the way that you do it is to take the letter and then you walk into the middle of Oxford town centre. And you steam it open on a steam vent on the street.
Yeah,
which
I remember now.
Doesn't have, and in fact, no city to my knowledge in England has, in a game where you have access to a kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's like, if the puzzle is to steam the letter open, then let me use a kettle. I have solved the puzzle. We don't need this intermediary, you know, bullshit step.
Yeah, that's kind of like the wine in Mobius. There's no real world scenario would present that as a viable option, you know?
Well, first of all, that there's no liquor stores in Washington, D.C. And second of all, that you would buy a bottle of booze at a bar.
And thirdly, that you'd fly back from Washington to New York and back again.
Yeah.
Where the girl you were meant to give it to is sort of still sitting and waiting for you.
Yeah. Well, you know what irked me? And I've mentioned this several times. Yeah, but the puzzle that really made me laugh was the whole bit about, like, in Central Park with the rally and having to distract the guy and the girl over for hours. But the thing about that, now that I live in New York, realizing that, you know, Malachi's apartment is down in the financial district, and he goes to Central Park, and the trip that he does on a good day would take him about 3.5 hours, and the rally only lasts for 2 hours in the game time, so... Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a bit like Phantasmagoria 2, where they have this whole thing where they'll regularly just ditch work and go to this bar called the Dreaming Tree. And clearly, whoever just made the map just like, oh, whatever, I'll put it there. And so you have this entire office people, whenever they just want to nip out for a few minutes, they go to the other end of Seattle. It's like, there must be a bar closer to your office. I mean, there must be. A Starbucks somewhere. I know it's the mid-90s, but they were spreading.
there's cases you can ignore it. Like, well, I know even like you look at the Blackwell games, the amount of travel over New York must be just...
just
3 days worth of travel, you know.
The fact that Lauren Blackwell can traipse all over Manhattan in one night is pretty impressive in the 70s, no less.
But you can overlook it.
But I mean, so often I think that the worst thing which can happen is when the game tries to justify it, and it's like, no, we know it's bullshit. I think with Mafia 2, basically has this sort of comment near the start where the main character gets injured, and then another guy just sort of actually points out, you know, wow, it's a good thing you heal really fast. And it's like up to this point, I was suspending disbelief in that. But now I can't stop thinking about it. In a few years' time, I'm going to mention that on a totally unrelated podcast.
Good. That's becoming Monkey Island with the holding the breath for 10 minutes thing. That's what that's doing.
Yeah.
Basically. Yeah. Ah, dear. Where did we get to? Can we talk about David Cage now?
No. Like, we don't do that enough.
He's our favourite lunatic. But I will say, like, we were talking about real-time stuff before. I really liked the very first scene in Indigo Prophecy where you're in the bathroom, you know? It was not... Yeah, it's not at all indicative of the rest of the game in any other spot, but it is a really great piece of design.
I think that I should point out that I consider David Cage to be a terrible writer,
absolutely
a misogynistic creep, and a pretty poor designer. But I do think occasionally he hits an absolute genius moment. Yeah. I think Heavy Rain had a few of them. When you kind of get into some of the trials, and you know the individual, they don't mean anything in the great sweep of things, but kind of in the moment, they are really, really good. And I think that Indigo Prophecy.
You can call it Fahrenheit. I've got Fahrenheit. I actually imported it from the UK.
Indigo Prophecy is a terrible name.
Yeah.
I'm going to call it Fahrenheit.
Despite the fact that the temperature in the game is all measured in Celsius. Just want to point that out.
Which is hilarious.
Yes.
That opening scene, I mean, it's... Again, it's something a bit like the Hitman example. It's actually sort of a scene which I pointed people a lot to in the past when we have to kind of get into this, like, what do you want adventure games to be? And it's like, I don't necessarily want them to be Fahrenheit, but I do want that sort of, when they're going to do tension, that's the tension I want. You know, when it kind of sort of brings up like the split screen view where you see the police coming in, where you find yourself in a situation, it's like, how do I deal with this? Again, like the many ways that this could play out. Mm-hmm. And it's genius. And then obviously a couple of hours later, you're rescuing a kidnapped girlfriend from the top of a roller coaster in an abandoned theme park, and then the internet tries to kill you. So yeah.
And then you replay an entire scene from The Matrix 2, which is a film that doesn't exist, so there's that.
And then the main character leaves a trained homicide detective in the car with her gun, while he goes to fight a man who has repeatedly shown that he can take over his body and use him to kill.
Yeah.
Because David Cage.
Yeah. I think though that, like, you were saying about how you've got, like, the split screen, the picture-in-picture effect where you've got this little thing. That's a real strength of, like, video games, is that you can show that and you can give the player more information, and you've got all the processing power to do this stuff. Why aren't we doing this more, you know?
And you can also give the options. I mean, it wouldn't work in the case of Fahrenheit, but I mean that sort of specific environment. But I remember when Telltale was talking about The Wolf Among Us, and I don't think they ever actually did this in the end, but I remember them sort of talking about it. One of the ideas they had, which I thought was actually really clever, was the idea that you might actively lose fights. And so I was thinking, so for example, there's a good scene in I think the second episode where basically you're investigating a murder scene, and Beast, as in Beauty and the Beast, basically sort of comes up and sort of sees you with Beauty, gets the wrong end of the stick and kind of goes mental on you. He sort of fully hulks down and sort of starts beating you up. And that was kind of a fantastic case where maybe I would like to just fight defensively and wait for him to calm down, rather than having like the full-on, you know, brawl, and kind of I can express how I want that situation to go using the same QTE mechanics, but beyond just pressing Q repeatedly when sort of told to punch him in the face.
Yeah.
And again, there's so much of this sort of kind of stuff which is just begging to be taken.
Mm. There's a lot of potential out there that I think we haven't tapped yet, you know. And I think people have got the idea of quick time events and go, oh, we can make it more like Heavy Rain. You know, we can control him taking a shower and all of this crap, whereas
we can have her taking a shower with three different viewpoints and a leisure centre shower block, just to make absolutely sure that we can get the virtual cameras in there, because David Cage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're very different shower scenes.
Yes.
but I think there's this fascination with QuickTime events where I guess they're a way of showing interactivity, but I think hopefully there's better ways of doing it, you know.
To give Heavy Rain some credit, I think that most of its QCEs were actually pretty well developed, because they mapped to what you were actually doing in a way that kind of most QTEs don't, where it's just like kind of press Q repeatedly because it's Q, press square because square. Whereas in Heavy Rain, it was like kind of when you open the door, you would actually sort of push the thing to open it. When you would sort of throw a punch or something, it would be on the right side that you were sort of pressing the button. It felt immersive in a way that most of them don't. And I think that the way that the individual scenes would then path, so that if you were doing really well, then the scene would kind of sort of flow off towards the right, maybe, and so you'd sort of start smashing something into a TV. If you were doing badly, maybe it would sort of path off to the left, and you'd be kind of on the defensive. I actually think there's a lot of potential for that kind of thing there. I don't get why QTs have never had, you know, multiple options, like kind of either do this or do this, and then have the animations queue off for both of them. So, I mean, that is such a... If you're going to be choreographing this stuff anyway, that's not, you know, that much more work.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's one QTE that I thought was kind of clever in Heavy Rain towards the end when you're playing as Norman Jaden, or Norman Jaden, as I like to call him. And he's interrogating the guy at the junkyard, and he has one of his withdrawals from his turkey drug.
And his nose blood.
Yeah, exactly. And,
oh no, I'm out of bullshit.
Yeah, and then you have to you have to hold down like every single button on the controller in the right order in order for him to take his drug. And it's difficult, but it can be done. It kind of presents you with the idea that, oh, we just put this in here to tease you. But you actually can do it, and it plays out completely differently because you avoid the fight with the guy and he just arrests him, which I thought was a nice little touch. Because I hate it when they give you the option, it seems like you can do something, but then you actually, illusion of choice.
I think it's got to be done very, very well. I mean, I know that the Walking Dead 400 Days has one of the worst bullshit moments I've seen recently. Bonnie's story. She's basically a ex-druggie who's sort of traveling with a married couple. I think it's been a long time, so I might be getting some of the details wrong.
There's
a bit where you're in this cornfield, and you kind of got these sort of sinister people who only really sort of see via shadows and torches, and it's relatively nicely done.
Yeah.
But there's a bit where you're kind of up against a tract or a fence, or there's some obstacle which you're sort of pressing up against, and you see someone coming down towards you with a torch, and the QTE prompt flickers, but you don't know who it is. And if you don't do anything, and I didn't do anything because my gut reading was it wasn't one of the baddies, or alternatively, that the baddies weren't actually going to be as dangerous as they sort of seemed, because it was like everyone was running on paranoia rather than having an actual reason to be terrified of these guys. But I'm going to see how this plays out. And so I didn't do the QTE, and so of course when the shadow figure gets up close, he coshes her on the head and it's game over. Mm-hmm. And then, replaying it... do the thing, and kind of this time, of course, press the QTE. But this time, the same shadowy person is now the wife of the couple that you're with.
Yeah,
and it's like bullshit. It's like if you're gonna do that, you absolutely cannot be caught.
Yeah,
and it's like if I catch you once, I then every decision you present to me ever again is going to feel like a false choice, or at least there's going to be that effect to sort of the smoke and mirrors. And it's never worth it, ever. Well,
I spoke with someone who had a similar reaction in a different part of that game, which was when you're on the bus and you have the shotgun and you have the choice between, who of the two guys you're going to go with. And they're like, oh, the gun. And she told me that she had clicked on the guy expecting the character to toss them the shotgun, but instead you actually shoot him. So she was like, oh my god, what did I do?
I had the original Witcher game. There's a part near for the first chapter where there's a witch, and basically most of the first chapter is sort of you've got the witch sort of saying the townspeople are dicks, and you've got the townspeople saying the witch is evil. And basically the answer is that both of them are kind of right. I mean, there's sort of problems on both sides. But you end up sort of in this sort of cave where the witch is sort of hiding out, and there's like an angry mob outside. And basically, you talk to her, and she's just sort of straight up like, fine, okay, you've got my secret, I'm really a witch, and yes, I did curse the townspeople, but they totally deserved it. And so, looking at my list, basically, it's like, okay, well, I've seen they are kind of dicks, so I'm not writing either side off at this point, and so there's an option, something on the lines of, I'm going to need more than that. And I'm willing to listen to you, but you're going to have to do better than they're dicks. Yeah, it's like kind of sort of tell me what happened. You give me your full story, and what actually happens is it flips a card, and it plays one of their sex scenes with a little sex card kind of popping up.
Oh,
here's a trading card.
And when it comes back, so I kind of well now you've got what you want. It's like no, that's absolutely not what I was going.
Yeah, I think the Witcher, the first Witcher, has some of the most awkward implementation of romance in any game possible. It's basically, any chance you can sneak a little bit of that in, let's do it, It's just, I like flowers, here's flowers, here we go. I like red gloves, here's red gloves, here's my collector's card. Why?
I like random anonymous sex with albino people, again.
Well, there's that.
They don't even try.
No,
the sequel did it way better, I think.
Yeah, the sequel is like, Because the original Witcher, they were, you know, they talked about how they were going to play with grey zones and everything like that, and they kind of do, but it does feel really awkward. And then you get to the second game, and it actually feels like, okay, there's a point. You know, I'm not just bonking random people here. There's a point to this.
So, well, it's a bit like the first proper sex scene with Triss, where they're kind of in the underground thing. Kind of temple thing. I mean, it's more explicit than basically any other sort of sex scene I can remember in a non-porny game. In that it's got a full nudity, it's got kind of magical undressing, it's not pornographic, but it is fairly explicit, you know, for by the sort of game storytelling. And it's completely uncontroversial. Because everything that happens is totally true to those characters. Whereas you go back to the first game, you have the problem isn't that, you know, the cards have nudity on them, it's what it represents. It's like kind of that gotta catch them all Pokemon thing, where the only one you ever actually get is Squirtle.
Oh dear. Yeah, I never understood the point of any of that in the original game. And in the second game, I thought, this actually fits for once, you know? Like, I realized that that was the whole thing about The Witcher was that it was this setting with drugs and, you know, all that sort of stuff in there, and they were trying to make it seem adult, but that just makes it seem more immature to me, you know? Like, here's some teenagers making a game about boobs.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, kind of, we can do anything we want. We wanted to do this. And it's like kind of, no. It's like kind of, I mean, I think The Witcher 2 is actually a really good game. I think it is very successful being mature. But I think a lot of the time it's like kind of Planescape Torment is a mature game. Broken Sword is a mature game. This sort of stuff, this is childish. It's just childish that children aren't meant to play.
That's right. Yeah, there's two totally different definitions of the word mature there. One's things kids aren't meant to see, and the other's this is something that is actually we've thought about, you know, and you're going to think about as well afterwards. So,
I'm not a fan of Gabriel Knight 3. I think it's awful. But I do really like how they handle the sex scene between Gabe and Grace. I mean, not the actual animated thing, which is obviously it looks like Barbie having enough with Ken. but I really like the kind of it explores like the morning after. It's like kind of, so what now?
Yeah.
And just how awkward it is for the entire rest of the game, to the point, obviously, Grace ends up leaving to just be anywhere else. I thought that was sort of a genuine high point to that game. It's like kind of, it's not treated as like achievements unlocked. Grace!
Yeah, that's right. Sex in games is often really immature. Like, there's no point to it. There's no impact in it. And it is nice to see it done with impact.
Mm. No pun intended. On that note...
How is that a pun?
I don't know. But I was just looking for a way to wrap up. I think we should... we should win. Oh, that was no pun intended either.
I don't even want to know.
Well, you know, wrap up for safety and all that stuff.
You do know that when they sort of say, you know, wear a rubber, they're not talking about like a full-on Macintosh and, you know, hat.
Oh, man, I've been doing it wrong for years. Anyway, yes.
I wouldn't know. I play adventure games.
we make them.
Yes.
Consider that.
You make them out of... I don't even want to know what.
Anyway,
yes. Richard, where can these fine listeners follow you if they want to follow your work?
They can find me at richardcobbett.com, like George Stobart, 2 B's, 2 T's.
Oh.
And I'm also on Twitter, twitter.com/RichardCobbett again. If you misspell it, then that's not me.
That makes sense. And fair you also enough. Have a Patreon. Is it?
I do.
How do you pronounce it?
It's how I pronounce it. I've got a Patreon at patreon.com/probablyRichard, which people contribute to, and that kind of makes me feel weird and British. it's like every time one comes in, I kind of in my head, it's like kind of click the wrong thing, then and then like a few hours later when they haven't sort of taken it back, it's like oh this is
odd.
but should any of my patrons be listening, I am hugely grateful. Like I said, writing about games pays absolutely bugger all, and it really does help a lot. So thank you so much, any present and future ones.
There we go. And you should also definitely, one of my favorite things on the internet is Richard's Saturday Crapshoot. You get to see all, like, I love, everybody that listens knows how much I love weird, obscure games. So definitely check it out. There's some ridiculous games on there. I've learned a lot from reading them, actually. It's fantastic.
Just jumping quick. Obviously, they go out about 9 a.m. Saturday morning British time. The website, the way it's currently set up, is really hard to get an archive on. But if you go onto my website and then go into the article section, you can basically find like a sort of straight list of all of them really easily, and it'll jump you straight to the article.
There we go.
Yeah. Good. So
very good.
Yes. At BCT underscore podcast. For those of you who wish to follow the podcast individually, I am at Grunislav Games.
I am at Ben underscore 304, and thank you, Richard, for being on our podcast with us.
Yes,
and talking.
You are welcome. It's been fun.
Thank you.
It's been very fun.
It has been. We learned a lot, and we...
And we laughed at David Cage, which David is a success.
Well, we always laugh at David Cage, but yes, it's more fun to have other people along to laugh at
We didn't get to laugh at Roberta Williams.
That's a topic for an entirely different podcast.
I'm not sure I laugh at Roberta Williams. I just sigh in just a deep, deep sense.
Yeah. My laugh is kind of like the clown laugh where I'm really crying on the inside.
Tell you what, we'll dedicate podcast number 100 to just be completely about Roberta Williams if we make it far.
We'll get there. Very good. All right.
All right, good. Well, have a nice evening and go to sleep, children. Turn off your computer and go to sleep.